and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
In Alaska, 2 out of 3 people who are released from prison end up going back in. The impacts of recidivism go beyond just the former prisoner to their families and the entire community. But learning to re-enter the community can be hard. People have to find housing and jobs, all while trying to stay sober and rebuild social connections. During the One Course Discourse discussion at Beartooth Theater in Anchorage, the Alaska Department of Corrections worked with a group of community partners to share their stories of successful re-entry and how the community can support people as they exit prison. Morgan Jaco is the Reentry Program Manager at the Department of Corrections and starts off today's program. You can refer to our webpage at alaskapublic.org to view the slideshows that were shown at this event.
So Alaska currently has a recidivism rate of 67.08%. That sounds pretty high, I know. But what does that mean, and why should you care? The Alaska Department of Corrections defines recidivism as a return to incarceration of any convicted felon who within 3 years of release is convicted of any offense, which includes misdemeanor, felony, or probation or parole violation. So there are many factors that influence recidivism rates and one chances of success upon release. But today we're talking about the big three for success. So that would be employment, housing, and access to services, like behavioral health services. So all are intertwined and dependent on each other. Part of why it's so hard to fight recidivism. Taking a holistic approach, which means collaborative, team approach, something a bunch of people wrapping around that individual seems to be the most effective way. It's hard to address one aspect without addressing the other. So that old adage of it takes a village to raise a child, well, that's where we hope that you guys can come in. The Department of Corrections and many of its partners cannot do it alone, neither can the reentrants. Today's panelists represent individuals who have dived in and become integral to this process, helping reentrants as they transition out of incarceration. Each person has a valuable story to share. The fact that any of these reentrants are on this panel are huge. It takes bravery to sit up here and talk. But they're all here today because they decided that their past don't have to define their future. Our goal today is to start a conversation about something that affects all of us. Inmates, offenders, reentrants, however you label people coming in and out of the criminal justice system, there are people. There are still people. There are parents, someone's child, our friends and family. Just like anyone, they need guidance, they need community, and all of us to help them. So let's focus on the rehabilitative prospects that can occur when you're working with someone during their journey out. Reentry is holistic and focuses first and foremost on public safety and victim reparations, but also on family interactions and community engagement. While we talk today, please feel free to jot down questions, concerns, and ideas for us. We've got a blank piece of blank paper for you guys to jot down some questions in that packet that's at the front, FYI. So we'll have time at the end to discuss some of these and hope that this is just the beginning of the conversation, not the end. I'm gonna hand it off to our moderator, Ann Hillman, today. But before I do, let me ask you this. Would you rather have somebody bagging your groceries or stealing your groceries? The NIMBY attitude, not in my backyard, is pretty easy to come by, but it hurts us all in the end. We have almost 900 individuals releasing monthly, so we really need to take a look at how we're accepting them back into our community. Thank you.
Today we're splitting this up into 3 different sections. There's a lot of different elements of what makes reentry a successful process, but we decided today to focus just on housing, employment, and support services or behavioral health. And so we'll have about 15, 20 minutes on each topic. So if you two could both just introduce yourselves real quick for the crowd.
Hi, my name is Catherine Goody. Okay.
My name is Troy Buckner. I'm the Executive Director of New Life Development.
And Catherine, you're living at New Life Development.
Yes, that's correct.
Tell me a little bit about how you ended up living there.
I ended up at New Life. I've been in and out of the system for like, I think 10 years now. I came to New Life from coming from being incarcerated. I was in Highland, and I actually filled out my application for New Life while incarcerated. My probation officer in Highland helped me do that, and put in a good word for me there, showing that I was saying I was doing good in jail and whatnot. And I went to the halfway house and stayed up on it, called in, asked if my application had gone through. And when I got out on ankle monitor, because it's an approved place for ankle monitor as well.
Okay.
So that's somewhere to go from the halfway house without going back onto the street. I went there for 3 weeks on ankle monitor, and then I've been there ever since I got off.
So, all right. No. So it was a place.
It was a safe, yeah, it was a good, safe place that was just, you know, approved. Obviously, it was a good place to go, mm-hmm. approved by ankle monitor and probation and things like that. So,
So Troy, can you explain a little bit, like, we're talking about housing, and New Life Development is, it's a transitional housing facility, but it's more than just a place to lay one's head.
That's correct. So New Life Development is a nonprofit, a 501c3. We're funded by the state through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, who actually help subsidize the program fees of our residents. So we're not landlords, we're not property managers. New Life Development is an actual program. It's not an intensive program. There's some basic rules that our participants have to follow, and the participants actually help pay their own way there. So they're required to work, unless they're unable to work and on disability. But other than that, they're required to work, they're required to pay program fees. And what we give back in return is a place to live, a safe, sober facility, some light case management. We provide meals every day. We try to make our facilities as comfortable and as homely as possible, because those participants have to feel like they're at home. They have to want to come home. They have to know that they're safe when they come home. If they don't, if they're going to a place that's filled with drugs and violence, they're not even going to want to come home, you know, until they absolutely have to. So we work really close with the POs and with Department of Corrections to give them that safe space.
And Catherine, every time Troy said home, you nodded.
Yes, that's true. It's been a little while since I've had a place where I could feel safe and lay my head and have a bed and call home. Like when I lost my home at the end of last year, the place that I did call home, and so.
What do you mean you lost the place?
My family and I lost our place that we were living due to a death in the family, and so we all had kind of split ways, and because of my behavior and stuff, I couldn't go where my family had gone, and so having a home, like having New Life, yeah, it became home. Like mm-hmm. It's a very important part of life.
And in talking to you before mm-hmm. the panel, you mentioned that you had been dealing with some substance abuse.
Yes.
Can you talk about how that substance use played into your transitioning back into the community from prison? Like, did you have a place to go other than New Life that would have been safe, that you could have also stayed sober?
No, I did not have any place prior to going to jail. I went to jail 4 times last year, and every time I would get for PTRPs, which are petition to revoke probation, I would get out, I would see my PO 1 time, and then I just, you know, I had my mom's place, but I knew that I wasn't held accountable there for my actions, and so I just would go back out, and I would just run for my probation again, it was safe, but it just wasn't a good place for me to get to a better place in my life. I felt like there was just not, it was just there, and I couldn't get myself back up to starting a new job or things like that. And so it was just rough.
And it was rough to start a new job because?
It was rough to start a new job, just like waking up every morning. I just felt like I was really stuck there. Mm-hmm. And my relationship with my family due to my substance abuse was not good. And I just wasn't getting clean there.
Troy, how does New Life help people get clean or stay clean?
Well, we don't really do that. They have to do that. They have to stay clean. All we can do is hold them accountable. Our relationship with the POs are that it's a give and take. You know, there are times when people mess up and they've been with us for a while, and I know that they're trying hard. You know, and so I will communicate with the PO and say, you know, they messed up. They're going to come see you. They're going to talk about it. If you don't take them back to jail, we will give them another chance, you know. But then there's other people who come, and within 2 or 3 days, they're getting high. And they're just we're not a place where we have to take everybody that gets sent to us. We don't do that. We're very particular because with our women, we have about 40 women and about 55 men right now. One person can come in and mess up the whole bunch, you know? And so it's different when somebody comes right away and they just need a place that was PO approved to sleep, but they have no intention on cleaning up their lives and getting back in order. We can't do anything for them, you know? We just let them know this isn't the place for you, you know, go away and give that bed to somebody who's serious. And so what we do is, you know, we have structured rules, we have curfews. You know, if you're not working, there's no reason for you to be out at 11 o'clock at night, you know, because 9 out of 10 times, you got arrested after 11 o'clock at night, you know? So we have curfews in place. Some people don't like it, but it's part of the structure that they need. Some people come in knowing they need structure, you know? Some people come in resistant. You know, some people come in because the parole board said, this is the only place we're going to permit you to go, you know, because they know that we're going to hold those people accountable. Where it's not just because the state funds us, we're not just give us your money and you do whatever you want. It doesn't work like that. If we don't have any beds filled, then so be it. If there's nobody ready, but there's always somebody, you know, and there's always people in jail who are waiting for a safe, sober place before they can be released. And so I tell people all the time, if you're not ready, give it to somebody who is, and come back to us when you are ready.
Catherine, what made you ready?
I'm 29 years old. I've been in, like I said, I've been in and out of the system for 10 years. I've seen the revolving doors of DOC for 10 years, and just a lot of life experiences happened to me this last year that I knew that I had pushed myself to the point of, I'm about to go to the point of no return. You know, like I'm at that age where. Or at that place in my life, even not even that age, just at that place in my life where, is this what you're going to do for the rest of your life, or are you going to succeed at life? Are you going to want to be happy when you wake up every day? So, I was ready. I've said before I was ready, but I wasn't. I proved that I was ready this time by taking the steps to get to where I'm at right now.
And you, when you first got to New Life, did you like the structure? Did it work well with you? Did you resist it at any point?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say I resisted. I did. I knew that I do really well with structure. I do great with structure. I succeed. I excel majorly with structure. I did have a hiccup while I was there and did not follow the rules and was discharged because of it for the safety. I started using, and so I was discharged from the program and whatnot, and that's just for the safety of everybody there.
What did that feel like? Like what did you end up doing when
it was heartbreaking? It was heartbreaking. I remember I looked at my phone to, it was late at night, and I looked at my phone to see who I could call to see where I could go, and almost all the numbers in my phone were all people that were at New Life that were sober. Like, I couldn't just go to them. And so, I mean, that was a huge realization. I'm like, whoa, I have all these new friends, and yeah, I can't go stay with them, but you know what, that's crazy. Like, all my friends are sober people now. It was heartbreaking. I posted on Facebook at one point, and I usually don't post things on Facebook. I was like, dude, I just want to go home. You know, like, I would do whatever I could to come home.
And home meant New Life.
Home meant New Life, yeah.
So at that point, when you were released from New Life, you had a job.
Yeah.
How was it more difficult to maintain your job when you left New Life and ended up couch surfing?
Yes, it was. It was. I had to tell my job what was going on, what I had done, what had happened, and just I had to strive every day to make it to work. I kept my job while I was away from New Life. It was about 2 weeks that I was gone. Yeah, it was difficult. You don't have a shower. You don't have a shower every day. You don't have somewhere that you can know you're going to get sleep, wake up, and be able to grab something to eat and go to work and have somewhere to go at night. Like, when I got off work, sometimes I would just hang out and by my work so that I knew I would make it to work the next day. So not having New Life to go back to was just, home to go back to was terrible. And it was just a terrible feeling.
Troy, why did you decide she was ready to come back?
Well, we didn't decide. She decided. You know, we told her, if you want to come back, you know, we're gonna watch. We told ourselves, let's watch and see what she does. If she keeps her job, You know, she needs to get an assessment. Does she go get sign up to get an assessment? Does she do these things? Does she stay sober? Does she do these things? And if so, you know, then we'll give. She doesn't know that we're watching. You know, and so we watched, and after a couple of weeks, we gave her a call and said, "How are you doing? Okay, it's hard out there, huh? All right, well, come back and talk to us." And so she came back. She I don't know. She took off work or before work. She gets over there, and we start asking her, you know, what are you doing, and how are things going? And we saw that she was trying her hardest to stay sober, to stay clean, to keep her job. And so at that point, we said, okay, are you ready to come home? And and if you are, you know, this can't happen no more. And she was ready. And, you know, ever since, she's been the model resident.
But this is transitional housing. Eventually, you'll transition into something more permanent.
Yes.
What are you doing, and what does the program do to help people prepare to be in permanent long-term housing?
Well, we try to provide the life skills that a lot of folks who are coming out of incarceration or inpatient treatment after years of drug abuse, it's certain life skills that people just don't know. You'd be surprised how many people don't know how to do their own laundry, don't know how to cook, don't know how to do some of the basic things that are required to survive, don't know how to save. I mean, I've never been to prison. I can't even save money. So we all have, you know, some of these issues. By living in a program that actually, you know, we have 24-hour staff. If there's anything you need, we get you as prepared as we can. The case manager, who I believe she's here today, helps the residents every single, you know, day with whatever they need, so that when that time comes, and sometimes, so our program is 6 to 18 months. Sometimes at about month 17, we have to start. Okay, you have to go now. You know, I know it's comfortable, but the time's coming. And then what we also do with our grants is we help them with security deposit moving out. You know, and if they're part of Partners Reentry Center, which is another service in the community, they may help them with their first month. So we've actually had people finish our programs, move into their own apartment with landlords that we've worked with over the years, and not have to come out of pocket one cent. You know, and we'll do that because they need that last little bit of help. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the most we could do. That's the easy part for the most part. The hard part is on them, whether it's staying sober, with it's not getting a PTRP, making sure they meet their meetings with their parole officers. That can be very difficult, and then maintain a job that knows that you have to go to the PO on call. You know, those it's not easy for reentrance out there. You know, hopefully it gets easier.
It helps. It's helped a lot with me learning to pay rent. It's like a huge thing. I've never actually had to pay rent. I've never had to pay rent anywhere really. So this has been a huge thing for me to just. And I feel really good about it when I pay my own rent. It's like I'm 20. Like I said, 29 years old, and because of all the stuff I've done and gone through and put myself through, I've never actually had to like be accountable for my living situation. And I enjoy it. Being able to do it on my own, you know.
What do you think your next steps are to be ready to move out of New Life?
Next step to be ready. Right now I'm just happy in the program. I'm 4 months? 4 or 5 months into the program. I don't know if I'll be ready at the 6 month mark, but My goal would be to get out onto my own 2 feet. You know, maybe have some roommates from the program, people that I know that I can that are like I said on the same path as me and that I can trust, and just move. I just keep going forward in life.
All right. Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next topic, we're going to focus a little more on employment. Noticed it came up a lot during that last one, housing helped her keep her job. So if you both could introduce yourselves, please.
Hi, I'm John Woodard.
Okay, with Ironworkers?
Yes, with the Ironworkers Union.
All right.
Proud of our titles. My name is Anthony Ladd, Apprenticeship Coordinator for Ironworkers Local 751.
All right. So, John, you've only been with the Ironworkers for a few years. Tell me, how did you end up working with the Ironworkers? How did you go on a path from being in prison to with them?
So I got with the Ironworkers because the Ironworkers was the only employer to give me an opportunity. I had, before I got out, before I transitioned out, I had a number of resumes in at different companies, you know, stuff that matched my skill set, my education, and various things like that. And I didn't really, I didn't get any response, right? So,
well, pause. You said that matched your skill set and matched your education. What was that education, and how did you obtain it?
Well, while I was in, the other thing is, I was incarcerated from 1992 to 2015, so 23 years. And so while I was in, I went through a number of vocational programs through DOC, and then pretty much put myself through, with the help of others and of course DOC, two different college education programs. One was an associate's degree in computer science, and another one, the last one, was a bachelor's degree in business administration and general management. And so I had the academic education. I worked in Alaska Correctional Industries for 10 years, and that was like a 9-to-5 job, learning woodworking and furniture production. And so I got other credentials as well. So, you know, I matched those up with the different jobs I was looking at, and sent out the resumes, knew how to do all that, and really didn't get any response. And the Ironworkers was doing a DOC-focused training program at the time, and I kind of learned about it at the last minute. And I had a construction background, okay? I didn't work as an iron worker. It's a whole different animal, I came to learn. As maybe you guys saw in the video that was playing beforehand.
I saw the video.
Right. And so it was to work as an, to start as an iron worker apprentice, okay? So I got out in 2015 when I was 50 years old. So I wasn't sure what the physical demands were for the job until I got there for training. And as you see, you have to do something called Hell Week, where you have to run rebar around for a few days and get all scratched up and bruised up, and you have to climb a column and do something called the Death March. So those physical things, you know, I was determined to, yeah, to get a good job. And so with the Ironworkers, you know, you started out at, back then, $21.75. It's a union, so you had medical benefits and you had a retirement. So I was gonna make it. There was no option. You know, I was gonna make it no matter what. So that's how I became involved with the Ironworkers.
Okay. So Anthony, you started recruiting from DOC for the Ironworkers. Why?
It's a fun, interesting story that started off in our living room with my wife and brother-in-law. And the idea came to us. We were tasked with the idea of recruiting women for our trade. And as you guys saw the video, it's difficult to do the trade period, and we just have a lack of them. And we sat there, and the idea came from my brother-in-law that we should probably go to the women's prisons. It didn't even hesitate. And I thought about this morning, that contacted the women's prison out at Highland, Karen Jenkins, who put me in contact with Mr. Olson, who talked about what a good idea this program would be. Didn't even hesitate with the idea of hiring anybody from the DOC.
But like, why start initially, say, oh, women's prison, that's a whole bunch of women?
Because
like,
the trade itself is just inherently so difficult, and we're looking for people with grit, tenacity. And what I've found, most of our body is made up of members that have, you know, been kicked in the teeth and has had a pretty rough life. And so it seemed like a perfect fit. It really was. And we went out there, and it absolutely is. It really is. And going one step further, the program, we went out there, we interviewed the women, we did the same thing at the men's prison, brought them to our facility for 2 weeks, trained them up, and then we picked the ones that would make the cut, we felt. And when they got out of prison, they started with us at $22 an hour and benefits and all that good stuff, like he says. And the one part I didn't even realize until this morning also is that we didn't even ask our contractors about this program. I'm biased with the idea of their people too, and I've got my own past with. And you know, it's kind of funny. He's very modest, but he talks about his degrees, and he's more certified for my job than I am. But only through experience, I've been there 15 years is why I'm in charge, and I stand here with multiple felonies and a GED, you know. And for whoever gave me a shot, you know. And so that's why we went to these guys, and no hesitation.
But tell me about that, like, because I've heard over and over, and John is testament to it, that you apply for a job, someone's like, ah, oh, you got a criminal past, I'm not going to hire you. They just, there's an inherent distrust within the communities. And, but you didn't have that distrust. Is that just because your personal past? Or
no, I would say all of it. You know, I just, I'm tasked with, I don't have the luxury of being too picky on people that can do what you saw in the video. And so I'll take anybody that's got a beating heart that wants to do it and that actually can do it. And we'll find out if you can. But also with my past, you know, I'm the training trust coordinator, and I run an apprenticeship. And once I took over this company, you know, it took me four times to apply as an iron worker. And when I took over this company, I got a hold of my file, and it said right there in it, you know, rejected repeatedly. And they had my jacket on what my arrest record was. And so I know for a fact it kept me out, you know. And so the whole idea, and after all I've done and all the programs we create, and it seems ridiculous to judge them. And I'm kind of sitting here with this guy. If we stood up and looked at everybody, who do you think's the boss and who do you think's the, you know what I mean? It's like he's very, you know, you can't judge a book by a cover. And the stories I've heard from these guys that we've had in our program, I got one gentleman who told me, or he said out loud that he couldn't get a job picking up dog crap. You know, and it hit me really deep. I said, man, you know, you can't get a job picking up dog crap. Like, what could you possibly do, you know? And the idea, what I'm hoping to get to the employers here is this idea that these guys pay their debt to society and, you know, they got a receipt and they're good to go is not the case. You know, my wife will tell you, we moved to Anchorage, you know, just to move down here to better my career. And we couldn't get an apartment because my felony got red flagged. And that was a wake-up experience for us. We were like, what are we going to do, you know? And I didn't even remember the felony.
Because you're both employed professionals.
Absolutely. You know, I thought the credit check and the felony would be no problem, but no, we couldn't get an apartment when I moved here. And this is 20 years removed from my crime, you know? Mm-hmm. It was kind of ridiculous. So we bought the duplex.
Solve that.
Yeah.
John, when you were rejected from all of these places and then suddenly the iron workers took you on, tell me what it was first like to start this job and be part of the community again.
Well, you know, my circumstances are kind of, you know, unique in that I'm a long-term prisoner. I was in for a long time. So it was all kind of like a whirlwind of activity, you know, getting into the housing. And I was really fortunate to have good housing initially. And so getting into that, then getting into training, and then being put out in the field, actually to do the work that I went to be trained for 10 days. And I didn't know everything, you know. There's no, you know, I was winging it. And so, but failure was not an option for me. And so that was kind of the way I kind of, you know, pursued the whole situation was, I'm going to do what I can to make it, no matter what it takes. And so, you know, and the thing is with the iron workers and working as an iron worker apprentice, there's a lot more, it's a lot more physically demanding. So, you know, you're low on the totem pole. And, you know, at 50 years old, you know, I'm working along younger guys that are apprentices, right? And so you just have to swallow that, you know, like, you know, for a guy that's older, maybe has some work experience, has education, it's like, get all that out of your head. You're here to do this job and focus on that, you know, what's coming tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next day. And then, you know, over time, a couple months goes by, weeks, months, and now a couple years. It's been a little over 2 years, and it's going great. You know, just stay on the path. You know, that's kind of like my motto. You know,
stay on the path. What do you mean, stay on the path?
Well, you know, stay. You know, I guess swim along in the current that is, you know, the free world. It's a weird analogy, or you know, it's totally different than living a life incarcerated. You know, in the structured day-to-day, you know, provided with a meal, you can do this at this time and this at that. You know, when you're in for many years, like, you know, a couple decades, you get accustomed to that. And when you're out, there's a lot more accountability and responsibility that you have to absolutely follow. And that's, you know, I would define that as maybe the path. It's what everybody's doing, you know, collectively to make up a community and doing your part and carrying your weight. You know, everybody has a role, you know.
Does having this job change your sense of self and make you feel like you do have a bigger role in the community?
Absolutely. It does. You know, having, you know, a place, a place in the community, you know, at the Iron Workers Union. You know, now I have a different title, but you know, it's a really good feeling, and that, you know, that's what you strive for when, you know, you're in for so long. You just want to have the privilege and the opportunity to do that again, you know, to join back in to what everybody else is doing instead of just being somebody that is, you know, kind of drawing off of society, right?
Now you're giving back to society.
Right, or just playing my, you know, doing my role, playing my part, you know, just like everybody else in this room is, you know, everybody is doing their part, and so that's what I want to do too, you know?
Anthony, have you seen changes amongst the folks that you've hired out of DOC?
Oh, drastically, absolutely. I mean, I'm looking, I can see quite a few, Mr. Hrminski. You know, a lot of people that come through our program, we've been doing it 3 years. We average about 10 per class. And whether they made it or not, just the sense of, you know, accomplishment that they get, you know, with us for 2 weeks is through the roof. And we've kept in contact with a lot of them. And I'll say this to the employers, if you're in the room and listening, the fear is real. You know, I get it with hiring, you know, the jacket or whatever the case may be, the stigma. One thing that I did, you know, we had laws or lawyers guiding us, you know, we could not take XYZ, certain things with harmful schools, et cetera. Okay. But when it came to the people we did take, I didn't look at their crime, you know, because I didn't want to be judging anybody just like anybody else did. So I made sure not to look at the crime. And then, but when it comes to sending these guys out, you know, I get that with the contractor. But my guys, you know, these contractors are $1 million insurance policies. And I see it as a steady supply of workforce that it's just not being tapped.
So when you are talking to other employers, what kind of fears are they expressing?
Just the, it's almost like the stuff you see on TV or the memes you read. It's like, it's not even realistic. You know, I've had just as many relapse and go back from the program as anybody off the street that's coming in today. So there's no way to say that's better, you know. But, you know, just typical. Are they going to steal my equipment? Are they going to do this? Are they going to do that? Are they going to come in on drugs? It's like, well, there's no difference between him and her, you know. And so that's the kind of, they have a bad idea already on them, you know. And so just kind of reassuring them. We've been very fortunate. The guys we get really do care, and they're professionals, and they go out with a good attitude, and they want to be free. I mean, 23 years, I've never seen anybody want to go back, you know. But so far, it's been good for us, and my contractors are, it's actually been changed into our Department of Labor standards, which is very unique. It's absolutely accepted, and most trades are following. And ironworkers.
What do you mean it's been accepted into Department
of
Labor standards?
So our program, going to this place, you know, we have to follow certain selection procedures at Department of Labor accredited apprenticeships. And one thing I'm very proud of as far as it's been our standards that these guys can do our two-week course and be accepted into our apprenticeship, okay. And which is, it's just not even heard of, you know. So why would you do it, you know? But it's working out good forever. My hopes is all the trades follow in suit and kind of start with doing this. It seems like a perfect match as far as women and loyalty, and you know what we're getting out of these guys and girls is definitely it's a given. Again, it's working.
Are there adjustments that either of you have to make because of people's parole conditions? Does
that? Oh boy. that's I'm glad you hit on that one. That's I'll go first, and then you can speak for the rest of the time on it, because it's mind-boggling. If you are an employer and you're going to start doing this, it's not just you start and it goes good. You know, it's going to be, you know, we had certain issues where, you know, they got to be there from 7 to 5, but they've got to go, because of colors, John, go do a UAXY, you know.
Because of colors?
A lot of UAs. I've got my own opinion on a lot of things, like this algorithm or numbers that you guys do as far as these paroles. I've got guys that are doing everything they can possible, but they don't meet a certain criteria. It's a numbering system or something that makes no sense to me, you know, and it keeps them where they're at. And then the ankle monitor is the biggest thing that I see these guys losing money on, is I can't send him anywhere without a crow flies in any direction, 5 miles or something, without permission. And it's a hindrance by far to anybody I get out to work. And that's been our biggest hurdle so far, is dealing with the contractors and allowing them to take this time off to go. Otherwise, we wouldn't tolerate that. But it goes back to the body thinking that, you know, you did the crime, you did the time. Well, you know, they already did their time. And so we're working with them, you know. And I'm excited to hear the first panel. It's like we should be working with them as well, you know, as far as our people that get out. That seems like a great program. But yeah. You got something to say about it?
Well, it's a given, you'll have to report, that you'll have to, do the random drug tests. There's a lot of things that I know I'm not going to use drugs. I know I'm not going to drink. I don't, right? So, is it a waste of time? Well, it's part of a random thing. It's part of the program. But the level of supervision I'm on right now, being on EM, in 2014, I was accepted onto parole. I was given a effective date of 5 years, 2019. And that's my goal, is to transition to parole. It would be nice to transition sooner. Some of the things I have to deal with working and various other things and just being part of the community would be a little bit easier. I mean, I still feel really fortunate to be on some sort of community supervision and be on work release, first and foremost. But, as you get on it, you think maybe there'd be an opportunity to transition a little bit, consideration for that. And, there's more flexibility built into the programs now. They've worked with me. The POs have worked with me. There's no doubt about it. They've given me latitude, and they're trying a lot of new things. It's something you just have to work through. And, I see it as a transition. I don't see it as, I don't look at all the restrictive aspects. I look at the more, the other aspects that it's providing as well.
Can I add on to that my shameless plug? For every, pitfall or problem we did have with employers, UAs, ankle monitors, whatever, through relationship building and conversations, I'll say I've worked with countless POs and whoever, and then they rectify it. Mm-hmm. And that's been the learning curve for me, is not knowing why this can't be done or why that can't be done. But I've been in commissioner's offices and stuff, and they've been very proactive on making sure it works. And so I see it as a plus, and I don't want to make it sound like,
flexibility in
things are changing. Yeah, yeah, just not knowing, and then following the chain of command. Mm-hmm. But being proactive in front of it is kind of been the best help for me. And everybody's done a great job of, making mm-hmm. sure it is what it is.
And are there other things that you wish you would have known or done to prepare yourself for release? Like, to prepare yourself to be part of this working world?
Well, for me, I think I was pretty proactive many years ago, knowing that I'd need to, the skills I had maybe not be as relevant, right? They may, be dormant, or that to change my circumstances, I'd have to, do things differently, like get an education and learn new skills. And so I started that early in my incarceration, knowing that I would have to do it at some point, I would get out. And I knew, I figured I'd get out elderly, I'm 52 now. I didn't know if I'd get out maybe being older, and so I had to prepare myself for something that would be less physically demanding than a blue collar occupation, but I jumped into that anyway. So there are things that people need to do, such as the vocational, the academic. If a person has no skills starting out, they should go through the GED process. But keep moving, and they should be urged to. I mean, there should be enough programs, because it does pay dividends in the end. Even if initially you don't get the responses you want, because it's tough to get a job for anybody, even if you have credentials, for even a free person without a felony record. And so, people have to realize that when they apply, hey, I didn't get answered. Well, I know other people that don't have felony records that don't get answers either. So, I know that going in. And so I don't feel too singled out, but at the same time, it's nice to, if you do have the skill set, the credentials, the education, the experience, to be judged by that, and maybe not, the right job by your felony past.
Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We're gonna.
Thank you.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing stories of successful reentry and how the community can support people as they exit prison. This discussion took place at Beartooth Theater on August 25th. We return to Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman, who moderated this event.
So now we're going to talk about behavioral health and supports for once you're out of prison. If you two could both introduce yourselves, please.
Sure. I'm Wesley Brewington. I am the peer support supervisor at Cook Inlet Tribal Council. I'm also a person in long-term recovery, and what that means is I haven't had a drug or a drink since February 6, 2013.
My name is Venus Woods. I'm the reentry manager for Cook Inlet Tribal Council Reentry and Recovery Services. I'm also a person in long-term recovery.
So, Wesley, you actually have a connection with the last two guys talking about employment with the iron workers.
Yes.
Tell me about your path once you left prison.
So, yeah, I could get up here and talk about it all because, you know, a part of my journey was incarceration, treatment. I went to New Life while I was waiting to go to sentencing, so then back to jail. And then I was on the first trial run of the iron workers when they came into the jail. So I was picked to do that. And so I got out as an iron worker, still chasing my dreams, and really wanted to give back and help people. And now I'm a peer support specialist supervisor at Cook Inlet Tribal Council, which is really amazing. So my journey kind of involves all of that was up here.
So let's talk about what that peer support network is like. Venus, what exactly do you do as reentry and recovery supporters?
So in recovery services, we have several different programs, everything from assessments, intensive outpatient, we have the Ernie Turner Center, which is residential, and we have the Sean Loop program, which is a men's work-based treatment component program. And then in all of our areas, we have peer support. It kind of encompasses our whole building, really. And so I can let Wesley talk a little bit about what specifically peer support does.
Yeah, so peer support is kind of a relatively new concept of peers, somebody with shared lived experience that has been down the road as somebody that is going through that, and how that better helps them. So I support men and females in treatment or in the community also that are struggling and going through some of the things that I went through. You know, whether that be you know, OCS, maybe their kids taken away by OCS, they're going to court, maybe they, you know, or coming out of jail and reentering back in society and need some support, or don't know community resources, don't know where to go, and I can kind of point them in the right direction and kind of be there to support them in that. I show up for people in their court cases, and you know, it just means a lot to somebody. You know, it's like a traumatic experience going to court. You know, like you don't know what's going to happen. You know, and sometimes it might be your first time, or you haven't dealt with this case before, and I can be there to support them and give them some guidance and support.
Do you end up being not just in terms of pointing towards resources, but emotional support as well?
Yeah, also emotional support.
Can I interject? And not only emotional support, but our peer support specialists can actually transport our clients, so they actually go with them. So I have someone right now that I'm working with that's getting ready to graduate and is job searching. So I have him working one-on-one with a peer support who's actually helping him with his resume, helping him, you know, look for where the jobs that he's most qualified for are. He can transport him, you know, to drop off the application, you know, just be there every step of the way.
Mm-hmm. Did you, Wesley, did you have that when you were first released?
I did not have that when I was first released. I had the last guy that was up here.
And John, all right.
Yeah, and he kind of pointed me in the right direction, but I didn't have that. I do have a lot of family and I have a lot of support, but I was just really determined to make it and just keep doing the next right thing and I remember when I was working as an iron worker, because I felt like, you know, the barriers for my crime of having a felony would not, you know, I have a lifetime barrier crime, you know, and it bars me from working my crime is a robbery, but it's not, you know, to do with kids, but I can't work with kids. I can't work for the state. I can't work in a lot of places because of my crime. And so I really didn't know how to go about getting into the field that I'm in now. I just know that I wanted to help people. And I remember one day I just gave it to God. I was like, God, just take it if you want me to do it, you know. And then like 2 years later, I remember Anthony called me and said, you know, you're going to work in Fairbanks. I said, no, I'm going to work at Cookinland Tribal Council. And, you know, that's my dream. And he supported me in that. And, you know, me and Anthony are really good friends. And now I work for Cookinland Tribal Council. You know, I've been there for a year, and it was my passion, you know, and they got a variance for me. I had to get a variance to work in the field because I had a barrier crime. So, and what that looks like is like getting references and you know, them checking and all these, you know, it's a process, you know, and I couldn't work directly with clients for like a whole month while the variance was being put in. So like I was stapling papers and like filing papers in this little room in the back until like my variance came back, and you know, it did. And I've been there ever since, and I love it. Yeah.
So we're talking about behavioral health. Venus, when we talk behavioral health, is it any different when you're talking about it in the context of working with people who are reentering the community after incarceration versus just behavioral health for everybody?
I think it's a little bit different just because, you know, people that are getting released, they have so many hoops to jump through. You know, they've got to fulfill their probation requirements and, you know, wherever they're, if they have a place to live and trying to reunify with family and correct some of the damage they've done there. And then, you know, on top of all that, trying to, you know, get the assessment or get into treatment. And then on top of that, if they're riding the bus or if they're trying to get rides or if they're on EM where they can only be out 12 hours a day, it's a lot.
Reconnecting with families. Why is that such an important thing, and how do you help people do that?
So I think families, reconnecting with families is really important. It's something that I went through in early recovery. A lot of bridges that I burned, I had to, you know, to work on rebuilding those. And it doesn't happen overnight. You know, it's consistency over time. So I believe that, you know, that family support, and a lot of people I see don't have family. You know, they don't have family, whether they're in another state or they're not here. And a lot of people have kids in OCS, but I think that does bring us a sense of like self-confidence to somebody, like to rebuild those relationships and get their kids back, you know. And I've assisted and supported people in, you know, reconnecting back with their family. And you can just see them like light up, you know, and they have that support back in their life.
Mm-hmm. We've got several men right now at the Sean Loop program that are working with us and with OCS.
Can you talk a little bit about what the Sean Loop program is?
Sure. So the Sean Loop program is a... It's a work-based program here in Anchorage that has a treatment component, so they not only learn work skills, we have micro-enterprises that the men themselves go to work every day and manage these micro-enterprises. We do janitorial maintenance. We have contracts out in the community, so the guys go to work every day. We have wholesale, which is, they make sandwiches and baked goods, and then we sell them around town. So they get those job skills, and then they also go to treatment. So in the afternoons and the evenings, they do IOP, intensive outpatient treatment. And they live in the house, and it's a safe, structured house. It's amazing. It's unlike any other program. It's men only. We also have so the program is 8 months long, and once they graduate from the program, we have supportive housing. They can stay on. It's a different set of requirements, but they can stay on until they find permanent housing. So they work and they go to meetings, and all this time they have access to peer support and, you know, all the amazing things that we have.
Yeah, and I think that's such a big thing too, is the supportive housing, because, you know, to have somebody go through treatment and just be like, or even in jail, you know, just kick them out, like, all right, you're done, you graduated, or you've served your time, now go find your way. I mean, I think that's...
But if you've been through treatment and theoretically you've built up all of these skills, why do you still need the support?
I'll take this first and then Wes. Most people that have lived this type of life that we've lived have, one, either burnt all their bridges when they get out of treatment. They don't have somewhere safe to go. Or two, they grow up in a family environment where there's drug use and addiction throughout their family. So just because you've completed treatment doesn't mean that you're ready. It's forever. Recovery is lifelong. You have to stay active in your recovery. And the biggest part of that is having safe, structured housing. So I think that's where we need to pull our resources in, is in after treatment. What happens after treatment? Because that's where people relapse or recidivate.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I came from Nugent's Ranch. I was at Nugent's Ranch for 14 months, which is a pig farm out in Wasilla, and it's a treatment center. And we took care of animals. greenhouse and all that. So anyway, I came from that environment of being on lockdown, getting Niagara credit for my time in jail, being locked down for 14. I was institutionalized to Nugent's Ranch, and coming back to Anchorage was like a traumatic experience. And I came back to New Life, and New Life gave me the ability to live there, go to work, come home, be accountable. I had to BRAC, I have to, you know, take a UA, so I was still accountable to somebody until I went to sentencing. And, you know, they accepted me, and I think that was a big part of my recovery, was like being there and like learning how to like budget my money and like pay for my rent and like, you know, go to work and come home. And
you said it was almost like a culture shock when you left the ranch, and then also when you left incarceration, coming back into the community. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like what, yeah, talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so it's more of like a lifestyle that you kind of, you know, you learn while being incarcerated, things that you do, your mentality, and you kind of have to be like that to survive, you know, and it's kind of hard to differentiate between, you know, being locked up and being on the streets. Like some things you have to do in jail, you know, you can't show no emotion, you can't show any feelings because you might get taken advantage of. And I feel like, you know, coming from jail and coming back into community, it's really hard for a lot of people to, you know, like we're not in jail anymore, like that prison mentality, mm-hmm. you know, of not, of like, you know, for example, like snitching, like they say snitching is not holding somebody accountable for their actions. And, you know, just some things that I hear, and like, you know, I've been to jail, so like when I talk mm-hmm. to the guys in treatment that's coming out of jail, I'm just like, you know, we're not there anymore.
You know, and so it's okay to hold people accountable.
It is, yeah.
Do you feel like you have to get beyond ideas of fear that you have when in prison, fear of snitching, of being open?
Yeah, and I think, you know, early on, you know, coming out of jail and like trying to do the right thing. I mean, I got out of jail and I owed $39,000 in child support, you know, and I got out of jail and I think a lot of people just go back to what they know because it's I'm not gonna say it's set up that way, but it's so hard. Like, you know, you get out of jail, now you owe $39,000 in child support, and these bill collectors are calling you, don't have anywhere to stay. So a lot of people just give in and just go back to selling drugs or going back to doing what they know for the quick mm-hmm. money, and it just ends them right back up in jail, you know.
But Venus, you have programs that are specifically designed to change people's mindsets.
We do. We do. We have a lot of different programs, but it's the person has to want it, you know? And a lot of times, if you can just get them to have a little bit of success, that's what I say. I'm like, just give us 30 days. Let us show you a little bit of success, because it's like a fire. You get a little bit of success and you want more, you know? Because everyone wants to do better. Mm-hmm. But it is hard. Like Wesley said, you know, you get out and you have all these barriers, and they're going to be lifelong. There's still things, you know, when I first got clean, I thought, as long as I stay off drugs, my life is going to be just fine, you know? And I didn't think about, you know, I hadn't paid my taxes in 10 years. I had child support. I had to reunify with my kids who are now teenagers and everything that comes with, you know? I think once we just get the people in the programs and, you know, just really take it day by day and just invest in them and give them that small little bit of success, and then once they finish treatment, stay with them. That's one thing I love about Cook Inlet Tribal Council. We have an alumni program. We have peer support. Mm-hmm. Just because you graduate, we still want you involved with us. You know, we can still, you know, whatever your pathway to reentry is, whether it's, if it's faith-based, we support that. If it's 12-step, we support that. You know, we're really client-centered. Mm-hmm. We have about half of our guys that do 12-step and maybe a little less than half that do some of the faith-based stuff in the community. And there's a lot out there.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big thing, too, is actually supporting all roads to recovery, like you said, and it's finding what works for them. Because what worked for me might not work for you. And for me to, like, push my beliefs off mm-hmm. on you, you know, and, like, finding somebody. Like, I know this guy I was working with, and he liked to talk to trees. And that was his way of connecting. So we'd go out, and we'd talk to trees, you know what I mean? So it's, like, it's different for everybody. And, yeah, definitely finding that road that best suits them.
And you both said just that little taste of success. What was that for you?
I'll go first. I think for me it was reconnecting with my children. I think, you know, for me that was my little taste of success. Like my first year that I was out, I was on ankle monitor, and I lived, my kids were in a foster home, and I was across town from them. And my best friend was their foster parent, but I stayed away from them because I needed to work on me. I needed to finish my treatment. I needed to, you know, invest in myself and really be solid in my recovery before I took that on as well. So I really made sure that I did it the right way. But once I did, you know, take back over as their parental figure and, mm-hmm. and start, you know, just the day-to-day stuff is what my success was, you know. And for a lot of people, it's just learning to get up every day and go to work. It doesn't seem like a big thing for most people, but for people that have spent most of their lives in prisons or on the streets, that's a huge thing. And for me, that was part of it too, just getting up every day, going to work. Oh my God, I've worked at the same job for 9 months now, you know? It was a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. And I think for me, I think that just that glimmer was when I, you know, just didn't have that desire to get high anymore. I didn't have that desire to get to use anymore. And that it went away, like they say, you know, was like taken away from me. It was like a spiritual awakening, like a, you know, spiritual experience that I had with working on myself day by day. You know, as addicts and alcoholics, we want instant gratification. And, you know, it took time. And I think it took me like 2 months to even think straight. But I got that spiritual experience of like, I didn't want to get high anymore. I didn't want to use anymore. And I was waking up like naturally high. Like, look, I could look at myself in the mirror, you know, and I could accept myself. And I liked myself. And like, I started having like self-esteem, you know what I mean? Like, and I knew more feelings than just angry and happy, you know? Like, I knew all these different emotions that I could relate to, and it was, you know, I think that's when it really, I was like, yeah, I'm doing this 100%.
Did it change how the people around you reacted to you?
What was that?
Did it change how people around you reacted to you?
Yeah, yeah, so like a lot of people were scared of me in the beginning of my early recovery, you know, and like, I was approachable. I was, you know, people was able to talk to me without me like snapping. And so yeah, it was a good day.
And I think it feels really good when people, especially your family members or people that you've hurt, when they actually start to trust you again, you know? Mm-hmm. I remember with my youngest daughter, when I was doing good, but her grandparents were telling her, well, she's still on probation. Let's see in a few years if she's still doing good, you know? Mm-hmm. And now I've reunified with the grandparents as well, and they completely trust me. But just getting to that point where, you know that your family trusts you to do the right thing, even when no one's watching.
Yeah, definitely. I really think I wouldn't be sitting here today if it wasn't for DOC giving me a second chance. I remember I was in Palmer, and they gave me civilian clothes. I still had like 6 months left. They put me on ankle monitor in jail and like bust me back and forth to the union hall. You know, they gave me that extra chance, right? I mean, they was letting me leave jail. Like all the times I've been to jails, a lot of times, I've never went to jail and they let me out and come back later. You know what I mean? It was weird. And like they dropped me off at the union hall and then they'd come back and pick us up. You know, it was different. Like something was different. And I really wouldn't be here without the people that believed in me, gave me a second chance. And there's a lot of them, you know, that just saw something in me and took that. I wouldn't be sitting here today. I mean, even if it's not second chance, third, fourth chance, just don't give up on those people, you know.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been listening to stories of successful reentry and how the community can support people as they exit prison. This discussion took place at Beartooth Theater on August 25th. You can refer to our webpage at alaskapublic.org to view the slideshows that were referenced here today. I'm your host and producer for today's program, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.